G'day, folks. Talk to Graham Innes, a lawyer, author, company director, and he used to be Australia's Disability Discrimination Commissioner for nearly a decade. Vision impaired from birth, an absolute fierce advocate for people with disabilities throughout the nation and beyond. He's helped shape the DDA, the Disability Discrimination Act, and involvement in the United Nations with the Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities. And he's had his fair share of dramas coming up against major organisations, RailCorp to name a few. And if you like the podcast, hit that subscribe or follow button. And we've also got a Patreon page. The link is within the description. So if you want to roll with the squad and become a patron, that'd be great. And want to thank our sponsors, Permobil Australia, the greatest electric wheelchairs in the land. Wouldn't be sitting in anything else but these four wheels right here, and they've got great assistive tech also. So righto, let's get into it.
Keep rolling with Jake Briggs.
Oh, yeah. Mr. Graham Innes, thanks for jumping
on. Good morning.
Good morning to you. So I really appreciate you jumping on the podcast and having a yarn with me in regards to, you know, a lot of the hard work that you've done and battled for people with disability over many years.
No, it's a pleasure to be here, Jake.
And, you know, you've paved accessible paths for many people, no matter their disability. So before you started trailblazing as a fierce advocate, where did life begin?
Well, life for me began as a kid, the middle child in a family of three in inner Western Sydney, so I grew up in Ashfield. My dad was the chief executive of a private hospital there, so life was pretty good. We lived on the grounds of the hospital and grew up in a very nice house, which was sort of part of the hospital settings. And because Dad effectively lived on the job, we as a family were very involved in, if you like, supporting him in doing that job. And the great thing about my upbringing is that my parents didn't treat me very differently to my older sister or my younger brother. You know, they just expected me to contribute in the same way as others and to receive the same levels of support. And that meant that I wasn't stood out as a kid with a disability. I was a middle child, a brother, growing up with the rest of my family.
That's awesome. And going through school and feeling empowered by that, by your family and just treating you like the rest of your other siblings. So, but then having your disability being vision impaired, so did that feel empowered when you were going through school and just some of the barriers that you were coming up against?
I didn't run into a lot of barriers at school, to be honest. The first time I ran into significant barriers or challenges as a person with a disability was once I went to university and started to try to get a job. But I grew up, as I said, with this view by my parents. They had a good friend, a guy called David Hunter, who was also blind, but he was a member of Parliament. And that said to me, well, you know, if he can be a member of Parliament and not be able to see, then I can just do anything I want. So I didn't have my expectations lowered. Unfortunately, what happens to a lot of kids with disabilities is that with the best of intentions, parents put them in an environment which is protected and safe, but which limits the expectations of those children. And for a lot of people, it's very hard to challenge those limitations and raise those barriers. And I think that's what society does to us as people with disabilities. We experience what I describe as the soft bigotry of low expectations.
Yeah, that's it. You know, we don't have to be wrapped in cotton wool and pushed in a corner. It's like, let's unwrap it, let's throw us in the deep end and let's have a go. So, yep. And like going back, like back when you're going through those years, whether it's like at home or at school, and like I'm really interested in the evolution of assistive tech, you know, whether it's got to do with your environment, whether it's physical things, when it's got to do with Braille or some of the other implements that you use, and also you got guide dogs, but then also in the open environment when it's when you got tactile ground surface indicators and such. So what was it like, you know, coming up as a youngster and what you had within your grasp back then?
Well, a lot of the technology that we have now, of course, wasn't available. I started reading Braille at the age of 4, and that's my medium of or my access to literacy. And I think it's critical that anyone who is blind or vision impaired gets the opportunity to learn to use Braille, in the same way as it's critical for anyone else who can see to learn to use print. You know, it's the same rationale. And technology, much of it has evolved during my lifetime, which is fantastic. I started school using a Perkins Braille machine, which was a manual Braille typewriter, if you like. Very noisy and clunky and heavy, but very effective. It had you know, 6 pins which pushed dots through the paper, which created the Braille. But technology has evolved hugely, both in terms of communications, but also in terms, as you said, of travel. I traveled for the first 40 odd years of my life using a white cane, and did that pretty effectively. And then as I got into more and more senior roles, I decided that I would get a guide dog. And so I did that, and the last 20 or so years of my life, I've traveled with a guide dog, which has also been a fantastic experience. But yeah, we could spend the whole podcast talking about technology and the changes in technology. But what we can do now, compared to what we could do when I was growing up, it's phenomenal. And the only problem that technology brings for me and for other people with disabilities is that, again, because of these low expectations that I've talked about, some people set up their technology which blocks access to people with disabilities, whether it's the challenge that I had, for instance, just getting to this podcast, because the link is in a calendar that isn't accessible. It doesn't let you click on those links. And
apologies, you know, for that, and thanks for letting me know.
No. But I mean, it's just an example of how technology can be a barrier rather than an enabler. But if technology is accessible for everyone, it can be a huge enabler, Jake.
Yeah, that's right. So, and this is going back to when you were talking about the typewriter, because I was super amazed just at the speed and watching your processes, because the first time I sat down and had a good solid conversation with you was when I was having a meeting with, when I was working back with FPDN, and yep, when we were talking and just watching yourself went, because it was one of the first times I'd ever seen the contraption that you had and just the speed when you were talking and documenting that at the same time with what I assume back then was a typewriter that was punching in the Braille so you could record later. Is that fair to say? Was that the tech?
Yeah, it was a Braille display, a little bit like the one that I've got here next to me now. So it had a Braille keyboard just like that. And then here, the Braille display where you run your finger along and you can read the dots of the display. And so that's what I would have written notes on. Or if I was reading from notes, read from those notes. But that's a very big step forward from the machine that I spoke to you about, which is a manual process. This is all electronic now. And this machine connects to my mobile phone, so I can use it in conjunction with my phone to access emails and text messages and do all the other things that we need to do in our very technological lives these days.
Yeah, that's it. Everybody's trying to keep up, whether you've got a disability or not, just with tech and just the evolution. So when you, because I always get intrigued about the writing literature, the language, and the interpretation of Braille and just the coding. So can you give a brief explanation, like you're talking, if you got a set sentence and how that is that condensed in a shorter form when it's got to do with Braille, just of how you're sort of reading it?
Braille is not a language, it's a script. So in the same way as print is a script, so you can write in any language in print that you want to, and I can write in any language in Braille that I want to. Braille is a combination of six dots, as you can see with the six keys there on the machine. Don't worry about the two at the end, that's the backspace, that's the enter key. So it's a series of those six dots, and it's combination of those dots that make up the letters of the alphabet, and it also make up what we call contractions, which make Braille shorter, because as you can imagine, it's going to take up a lot more space than print. So in order to have large books rather than huge books, back in the day when we read on paper, then Braille is has contractions in it as well. So it's a combination of those dots that make up the letters and numbers and the contractions.
Yeah, pretty impressive. And when you're going through high school and uni, university, so what was that like? And because you're looking at uni, because you were in law, and just was a lot of that interpretation right, as and the amount of text books that were out there and documents, was that all at hand back then?
No, some of it was produced electronically, some was read onto tape, some was manually produced in Braille, so it was a combination. The challenge that anyone using Braille has is that there isn't the breadth of available material. So we have to rely on fewer books, and we have to know them better than someone who was perhaps able to access a print library or a library via the internet. That was the challenge back at university, and remains the challenge today, I think. But so I worked with large Braille books on paper, because we didn't have Braille displays when I went to university. I had a lot of people reading stuff onto tape, and I also also took my own notes in, I actually took them, dictated the notes during the lectures, very quietly whispered notes into a tape recorder, and then I wrote them up when I got home, which was a really time-consuming process, but a very good memory aid.
Hey, and it's led you up where you are today, so, and taking that time and patience, but what drove you to law itself, and what were the positives and negatives, and when you were going through that process?
Well, I suppose I was interested in our community. I'd always been brought up by my parents to be a participant in and a contributor to our community. You know, we had sort of, I suppose, middle class welfare values. We weren't poor. We weren't all that well off, but I was always taught that it was important to work in the community and to give back to the community and to support people who were perhaps more disadvantaged than I was. And I thought that law would help me find a path to improve the community in which we lived. It was as general a view as that when I was in school working out what I wanted to do. I was one of those lucky kids that knew what I wanted to do pretty early on, from the age of 15 or 16. I wanted to study law because I thought that I could help to improve things in the community. And then as I went through my legal studies, I got interested in particular areas and my focus was a bit more refined. But that's what drove me to study law in the first place. In terms of the challenges and the advantages, I mean, I've talked about a few of the challenges. I didn't have access to the same amount of material as the other law students. I often didn't get my material on time, so I was often playing catch up. And I think I spent a lot more time studying than the average student because of those barriers. I had a social life at university, but it wasn't what you would call an active social life. I spent a fair bit of my time working to get my law degree. I was also keen to get it as quickly as I could because I didn't want to spend more time than I needed to at university. So it was a four-year degree. I got it in the 4 years. But the big challenges that I faced were when I finished at uni, trying to get a job.
Yeah, so trying to get a job, you know, that next step. So you've gone through the hard yards, and that's what I wanted to talk about. So university's finished up. So then what were the prime goals when you left university within your community, and sort of where did that lead you when you obtained your first job role and when the doors started to open up and people are starting to recognize, you know, who you are as a person and not, you know, because you would have had a lot of mob out there when you're looking at ableism and, you know, and that's still rife today as well. So I'm just thinking back then and what you would have went through. But yeah, so take us through the goals and the process.
Well, I was ready to rock and roll when I came out of university. I was a lawyer. I'd done my degree. I'd done my 6 months College of Law. I was ready to make my mark, as were all my university colleagues. The problem that I faced was that the community, as you said, had very ableist attitudes and just assumed that people with disabilities couldn't be successful in those sorts of professions. And so most of my university cohort got jobs in the first 3 to 6 months after finishing uni and College of Law. Some of them had even got those jobs before they finished. I spent 12 months trying to find a job. I went to about 30 interviews in that 12 months, Jake, and because I didn't, initially I started telling people that I couldn't see. And when I did that, I just didn't even get interviews. So I stopped telling them that, and I let them find out when I walked into the interview room with my white cane, because at least that got me one step further. But I went to about 30 interviews, and I didn't get any of those jobs. Now, I was probably not the best qualified applicant for a couple of those jobs, but most of them I know that I was. And the reason I didn't get those jobs was because people just assumed that a blind person couldn't work as a lawyer. And I made a point of telling people at the interview how I'd thought about, you know, how I would work as a lawyer, what adjustments I would need to make and how I'd make those adjustments, what I'd done at university and in college to make those adjustments. But people weren't convinced, and I didn't get a job. So I ended up after 12 months realizing that I had to come at this problem a different way. So I applied for I did the public service exam for the New South Wales Public Service, and I applied for a clerical assistance job, which was like the bottom of a rung of the ladder in the public service. And in fact, my first job was answering the telephone and telling people the winning lotto numbers. And of course, you really need a law degree to do that job.
Yeah, you sure do.
I was made redundant from that job by an answering machine, but luckily moved on to other roles in the public service, primarily answering the phone and answering inquiries about property law. I worked at the Registrar General's or the Titles Office for a while, and then consumer law. But at every level, I had to prove that I could do the job. So whilst the rest of my uni class just walked into lawyers' jobs, I had to struggle for 3 or 4 years, maybe five, before I got a job as a lawyer. And it was only that I spent time when I was working at the Department of Consumer Affairs, just working as a clerk. And I spent time with the guy who was the head of the legal department. And I kept, we'd go to the pub on a Friday night, a whole bunch of us from the department, and I'd buy him beers and tell him how I could do the job as a lawyer. And finally, I convinced him to give me a crack at it. And then, I progressed in the role from there. But that was the path that I had to take, which was a far more tortuous path than most of my cohort.
Great. So when you're looking at, that's led you on to, you've got on the grind, getting through it, 5 years, and you really want to push and utilize this law degree and where you've got in and had a crack, but just where it's led you to when, you've achieved many reform for people with disability. So when you served as Australia's Discrimination Commissioner, what was the role like and the resources it gave you to assist Australia's disability community?
Well, I suppose I came to that role with a passion to get things closer to equality for people with disabilities. We haven't got there yet, but we're closer than we were. And that passion was driven by my own experience and the experience of many others that I knew, which had been similar to mine, that is the lived experience of disability and the barriers that we face in society. Mainly the attitudinal barriers, convincing people that we actually can do the work rather than having them rely on their own assumptions, which are usually negative and usually wrong. So I came to the role with that passion, and I'd been involved because of my legal background and my passion in the 90s of helping draft Australia's Disability Discrimination Act. I moved from the Department of Consumer Affairs to the New South Wales Anti-Discrimination Board, so I'd worked in a discrimination context, both as a lawyer and a complaint conciliator. So I came with the background of knowledge, and I helped the Hawke Keating government, which was the government that enacted Australia's disability discrimination legislation. And so when I came to the role of the commissioner in 2005, so sort of 10 to 15 years after that law had passed, because I'd helped shape that law, that gave me a real head start to find practical ways to work with the law to achieve change. So, worked in areas like transport, access to premises, access to buildings, making buildings more accessible, making transport more accessible, trying to remove all of those barriers that existed that prevented people with disabilities being successful in the community. If you can't use public transport and you can't get to work, then it's pretty hard to do a job. If you can't get into public buildings, it's pretty hard to do your job. So all of those barriers had to be removed. Again, I'm not saying they've been completely removed, but there's been huge amounts of progress in those areas. And so what drove me the whole time was knowing from my own experience and the experience of many others that I knew, the disadvantage that people with disability faced, and believing in the ability of myself and the many others that I worked with, because I didn't do it on my own, Jake. There was a whole bunch of advocates, people in my team at the Human Rights Commission, and fellow travellers on this road. It's been a combined effort,
Yeah, that was my
and
next question. That's good to hear, like all the other stakeholders involved,
Oh yeah, there's been huge. I mean, starting with the First Peoples Disability Network, but all of the organisations like that, all of the advocacy and lobby groups like that, they all play a key role in creating the sort of change that I've talked about.
Yep. 1992, and that's super important what you did touch on when you're talking about the DDA, the Disability Discrimination Act. Like, you've had a lot to do with it, shape it. Can you explain what it is, but also the power of it?
Well, in general terms, it makes it unlawful to treat a person less favourably on the grounds of their disability. I mean, that's in very general terms. So it is a law which prevents discrimination against people with disability on the grounds of our disability. And we were able to leverage from that act changes around transport, for instance, which started with people lodging discrimination complaints and then, you know, pointing out to transport providers that the sensible way to resolve these sorts of issues was not one complaint after another, but to put together a set of regulations which would, if you like, fill out the details of the DDA, explicitly explain how it would apply to transport. And we did that in the area of transport and buildings or access to premises. And I know, you know, your background in that area and
convention.
You would appreciate the importance of
convention
of setting a standard and then being able to measure against it to achieve compliance in the construction of a building, whether it's a public building or whatever it is, in these sorts
convention.
Of areas. So many of the battles
on the
have
rights
been
of persons with disabilities
in those areas using that law as the lever to say, well, look,
convention.
This the law says that you can't treat me differently as a result of my
convention.
Disability. You know, I can
on
lodge
the rights
complaints
of persons
if
with
you
disabilities.
Do, but let's find a way forward. Let's find a positive solution that removes those barriers.
Yeah. That's really important, just breaking that down the way that you did, just so the viewers and listeners can really get a grasp on the DDA and what it represents. But as said, the power of it. And like you said, it's when you're utilising that lever, because, you know, I've utilised it when you got access to premises and when it comes under AS 1428, the building code, and when you're looking at construction, and obviously when it's got to do with all the various types of disabilities. So, the United Nations Convention, people with disability that helped many individuals around the world, including yourself, with a big case against RailCorp. So, and hey, you don't have to start, and I don't want you to start charging me lawyer's fees if I start pulling out these questions, all right? No, but but when you're talking about the United Nations and with the rights of persons with disability, like the DDA, so just in your words, if you can explain what it is, the power of it, and then we'll segue in how it helped you with RailCorp.
Well, what helped me with RailCorp was more the DDA than the Convention on the Rights of People with Disabilities. But the Convention is an international treaty which provides, I'm just grabbing some water as we're talking, Jake, but
they have got power to help each other though, yeah?
Oh yeah, they have. There's no doubt about that. But what the convention does is, is clarify the law internationally, and in some respects, in many respects actually, in broad terms, it's similar to what the DDA does here in Australia, but it sets the ground rules for. Sorry, Jake, I'm just going to have to take a break.
You're all right, take your time.
So what the convention does is, if you like, it's the international platform for setting out the law around people with disabilities. And Australia has committed to the convention, but it's international law. What it's called in Australian legal terms is soft law. So it's not absolutely binding on Australia, but our government has committed to it, and it sets a standard for equality and non-discrimination against people with disabilities in countries around the world, many of whom experience far more discrimination than we do here. But it's the same sort of framework, really, as the Disability Discrimination Act. I mean, that's very putting it in very general, but hopefully more clearer terms. So what the things like the convention and the DDA can do is make it possible for people such as me to run cases such as the one that I did against RailCorp. And the story behind that was that when I travelled on a train in Sydney, whilst there were a whole lot of notice boards, signs on stations, which told people who could see where they were, there was nothing which told me where I was. There was no announcements of stations. And we had been lobbying for that for many, many years. And RailCorp basically, we started lobbying when New South Wales had anti-discrimination legislation back in the back in 1981. And RailCorp said, you know, basically, yeah, we'll get to it. Just wait. And
let's just push it started, in the corner for now.
Yeah. So we started again when the DDA was passed in 92, and again when the transport standards were passed in 2002. So eventually I said, look, I've had enough, and every time I go on a train, I'm going to, if there's no announcement, because there were some announcements on trains, I'm going to lodge a discrimination complaint. And I lodged, I think, almost 70 complaints over a six-month period. Because I caught
70, and they didn't and they didn't recognise this. To me, that's an absolute joke, and they didn't take it serious enough. And then it led to, you know, battling it out in court. It's just an absolute joke.
Well, it was a joke because they spent about $300,000 or $400,000 on the court case, which could have been spent in installing equipment on the trains to make the announcements. And I kept saying this to them. I met with the minister, I met with senior bureaucrats, and I sort of said, oh, if you actually start doing this, if you actually start making the announcements, I'll withdraw the complaints. I'm not here to, I don't want to have this fight, but I've got to the point where I will have it. And eventually they just kept saying no or kept delaying. And so I went through the courts and I was successful. And the force of the decision meant that they had to install the equipment in the trains. But, you know, Jake, that's not the way to resolve discrimination. You know, the sensible way to do it is for governments and employers and service providers to sit down with us and work out what the solutions are and combine to implement them. And
did that drive you more, like in respect of, like you've got your law background, you've got your stature in society and what that means, not just to yourself, but many other people in the disability sector and above and beyond. And then you got RailCorp still trying to come at you like this, and also what tactics were they trying to use? Like, it's hard for me to fathom all this, you know, like in this day and age. Like, it wasn't too long ago.
I find it was in the early 2000s. I find it hard to understand what their logic was, really, because you know, they just kept putting it off until I forced the issue further and further and finally got a court decision. And only then, when the court said they had to take the action, did they take the action. But that's, well, people with disabilities shouldn't have to be made to go to that extent to get equal treatment. We should be able to raise issues and get issues rectified. We shouldn't have to take things to court all the time. But I hoped that it would have the impact of having a lot more transport providers you know, comply with the rules, comply with the standards, and make the announcements. And in fact, it has, because around Australia now, announcements on public transport are pretty universal, because organisations have seen what one person who's prepared to just hold the line and say no, this has to stop, what the force of the Disability Discrimination Act can be.
That's it. So holding the line. So if we're going to move on to another form of travel, so you've gone through Railcorp, successful, great. Now, like, I think we're both on the same page here. So I've, and just the way I've felt about it, and when it's got to do with air travel, and when every time, and this is fine domestically, internationally, so when it's check-in, going through security, and me being in an electric wheelchair, like, it's almost like I feel like a terrorist. The way that I get pat down all over, and then it's getting out the mirrors, looking underneath the chair, like looking for whatever it may be, and then it's also swiping me down, and then they put that, it's like a little clip, they put it in a machine, and then that tests for drugs and whatnot. So, and that's every time that I'm flying. And yep. And that's, you know, out in the open in front of everyone, and, you know, I don't feel great about it. And, like, what's your thoughts about that? And I know you've had your own issues when it's got to do with air travel as well.
Mm. Well, unlike other modes of transport, the airline industry and airports have largely thumbed their nose at the Disability Discrimination Act for the last 20 or so years. And what they've done, which is very different to other transport providers. So what other transport providers have done is that they've tweaked the system we have so that everyone can use that system. So they've made buses and trains more accessible. They've made railway stations and bus stops more accessible. I'm not saying they're perfect, but, you know, they're on the way to doing that. And what that's done is that we can all, as people with disabilities, use the same system. What the airlines have done, and they were told this right from the start, but they insisted on doing it this way, is that they've set up a separate system for us so that, you know, people who use wheelchairs have to go up in those crazy forklift devices onto the plane.
Oh, DPLs, disability passenger list, Jesus.
Yeah. Because the, I mean, not for planes where there's an aero bridge, but for planes where you've got to walk on the tarmac, because the only other option is stairs. And then, Jake, they build ramps, because I live on the, use the Gold Coast Airport now, which doesn't have aero bridges, and they've got ramps there, which are replacing those stairs, but they've built them so that people using wheelchairs can't use them because they're too steep and they can't take the weight of, you know, a person and a wheelchair. So effectively, they've had the chance to fix the problem and they've just reinforced the problem so that they're still requiring people to be treated differently. And that's,
I wonder where they're taking the advice from. Like, because they're sitting down with a group of individuals. Like, who have they got at the table to design and put these things forward? Because it doesn't
clearly
seem
not
like
people
it's the
with
right
disabilities.
People. No.
Clearly not people with disabilities. And that's the problem, Jake. So we're not part of the, we're not at the table. And as the old saying goes, you know, if you're not at the table, you're on the menu. And so we just get sort of chewed up by the system because it's a system that is designed specifically to exclude us so that a parallel system has to be developed. And I've just decided that I want to do something about this. And I think we need law change to require, to mandate airlines to work to make their systems viable for many, many more people with disabilities, because they've been asked to do it on a voluntary basis for 20 years and they haven't. So it's time that there was law in place. But we also need culture change, because we've got to
change
the attitude.
That's the big one, culture shift.
Yeah. And that comes from the leaders of organisations, because culture in any organisation, whether it's an airline or not, comes from the top. And so we've got to get people with disabilities treated as human beings in the same way as people without disabilities. Now, of course, we have to have security processes. No one in these times of terrorism, no one's arguing about that. But the security processes have to be set up in a way that they minimise the extra impact on people with disabilities. Not the impact of security, because everyone has to go through
that. No, you can have dignified risk, you know?
You can have dignified approaches to the way the security system operates, and that's what the airlines have not done. And they haven't done it because they haven't built the system in consultation with us, because we could have told them ways to do that, and that's what needs to change.
Airport providers, CEOs, you mob out there that own the actual airports themselves around the country, listen, like, we need a seat at the table to get this done.
Yeah.
So we'll move on to the NDIS, the second largest reform since Medicare. And, you know, it helps a lot of mob throughout in all states and territories around the country. And what's your take on it as a whole? And what works well, and what do you think's missing?
Well, when the NDIS was designed, it was designed to be an insurance scheme for people with disabilities and to help us to support us to maximise our opportunities in lives. Since the election of the coalition government, it's been restricted financially, it's been over-bureaucratised, And it's been developed without many people with disabilities being involved in key management positions in its development. And as a result of that, it's a very bureaucratic system, which forces people with disabilities to fight the system rather than to have positive experiences within the system. They spend... So far this financial year, and we're only just in the beginning of June, Jake, so there's still a month to go, they've spent $40-something million on legal fees fighting against people with disabilities and their claims under the NDIS. Well, that's never what the NDIS was designed to do. And unfortunately...
Imagine the amount of money going towards people with disabilities and how that would have helped individuals?
Well, that $40 million could have been spent far more effectively than paying the fees of lawyers. And in all of these processes, people with disabilities, sadly, have lost trust in a scheme which we were really excited about because we knew it was going to change our lives. And for many people, it has changed our lives, and there are many more people with disabilities now receiving services than received them before the NDIS. So that part of it is really good. But there are a lot of problems with the scheme. And I'm hopeful that the new government, with Bill Shorten as the new minister, will start a process where, firstly, the scheme regains the trust of people with disabilities, because that's been hugely damaged over the last 6 or 8 years.
Yeah, it's a major swing now. What's going to happen?
Oh yeah, and then when that trust is regained, we have to rebuild the scheme with people with disabilities at the centre of the rebuilding process. So working with us rather than against us to make the scheme the best it can be, and that will require significant changes to the scheme. It'll require negotiation rather than legal fees, et cetera. Some pretty major change, but it's got to start with the renewal of that trust, which has been, seriously damaged.
Yeah, so it's a massive portfolio, you know, when you're looking at the individuals across the nation.
Oh, yeah, more than 500,000 people. So 10% of the disability population benefit from the NDIS. It's a big ship to turn around. It can be done, but it's got to be done with people with disabilities at the centre of the decision-making processes.
Yeah, you know, and not just to throw you in the mix, right, but when you're looking at Bill Shorten has taken this on, new government in, massive swing. Now it's in a whole new direction. And like you said, it's gaining the trust. So, you know, you're a strong strategic advisor. And in your words, succession helps others to step up. So not meaning to put you into the spot, but hey, the government should be knocking on your door, hey?
Oh, well, Jake, we'll see what happens. But, you know, if it advances the cause of people with disabilities, if it benefits the lives of people with disabilities and makes those lives easier, then I'm there ready to step up and do the work.
Yeah, there's a lot of solid visionaries like yourself that are paving the way for people like with all types of disabilities. And like the spectrum is large and vast, and there's a lot of people that can't speak for themselves. So we need a lot of people out there to step up. And if it's talking to the local members or talking to trying to get straight through to Bill Shorten or however, wherever they can, to be heard, you know, so then we can have more voices at the table. And like you said, it might, that might ease some of the restrictions, and it might, you know, and where it is more of those negotiating terms instead of just fronting up with lawyers. And like you said, like some of those fees are insane. That's a lot of money, and where that could have been redirected somewhere else.
Spend money that way. Yeah, that's right.
You know, but we'll get there, and it's going to be interesting to see. So hold on to your seats, people. But Graham, like, you know, you're a bloody author too. So when you're looking at your book, Finding a Way, like that really resonates with myself, because like the title of it, because like with me and my journey and through disability, like when it's coming up with barriers, no matter what they are, like me and myself, it's always having it in the back of my head to try and find a way in whatever level that may be. So, like, and I'm really impressed. So just tell us about your experience going through that as an author and just the launch and just, you know, I know it was a while ago, but, you know, it's a lot of solid information and just how that represents who you are in Australia and your staunch representation for people with disability.
Well, I always said that I didn't want to write a book because I was a doer, not a writer. I wanted to get on and do things. I didn't want to write about it. And then when I finished at the Human Rights Commission, a number of people said, you know, you should tell some of these stories because they can be really empowering to other people. And that's really the main reason that I told my life story in the book. And my life has been finding a way. As a person who can't see, that's often what I have to do. But it's also the metaphor for my life. If I haven't been able to resolve a problem in one way, then I find a way, another way to do it. And it's a bit of a sporting metaphor too, Jake, because, you know, they say that players in sport, the ones who are successful, find a way. And that's what I try to do. So that was the rationale behind the title of the book. And I really enjoyed the process of writing it. I mean, sometimes writing is hard work. So I'm not saying it wasn't hard work at times, but I enjoyed the process of writing it and sharing my stories, because I really do think that storytelling is the way to, you know, to create change and to empower people. If they can see someone with a disability who's been able to have the, you know, grab the opportunities that I have, then that can help other people to grab similar opportunities. So hopefully that's what the book does. If it does, then it's been a success.
100%. Strong words there. And a lot of strong words when it comes to, you know, fingertips and the tech that you use when you're looking at social media, because I know you're an avid user of Twitter.
So, oh, yeah, I love Twitter.
Yeah. So, how, like, and I know that can probably be a whole podcast on itself when it's got to do with social media and some of that other tech, but if it's just sort of summing it up to some degree. So, when you're looking at Twitter and how it works for you and your disability, because I'm always fascinated by that when it's got to do with people that are vision impaired, and because knowing, because you're scrolling through, knowing when to stop, how some of the voice activation works, how some of the written word is, you know, explained back to you through voice. So just run us through that, and because you're pretty quick to the chase when you don't muck around on Twitter, mate.
Well, you know, I find Twitter a great way to you know, get my news of what's going on. I'm a news and current affairs junkie. There's no doubt about it. And I find it a very effective medium, basically because it's text-based, not picture-based. And that's why I don't use, to anything like the same extent, other forms like Instagram or Facebook. Twitter really works for me. And I use it with both Braille and speech output technology. So the phone speaks to me what's on the screen. And I've, you know, found a particular Twitter client which is pretty accessible, works well with the way that I want to use it, and I find it a very effective means of communicating with people.
You sure do. So you make some waves, and it's a good way to do it, especially in the forum that what it is and what Twitter represents. And you know, and it's going to be interesting that now this new government's in, and seeing some of your tweets come along, Graham, so looking forward to it. Keep that up.
Yeah, I will.
Yes. So in regards to, you know, because you served on many boards and you're all right, and you're continuing to serve on many boards and being a strong voice, strong advocate. So in regards to advocacy ventures, where are you up to now? What's going on?
Well, my life now is as a company director, so I sit on a number of boards, and that's a great opportunity to share some of the experiences that I've had over my life and the experiences that I've come across working not just in the disability fields, in other fields. I sit on the board of the State Insurance Regulatory Authority in New South Wales, so we regulate compulsory third party workers' comp and home building insurance. You know, I can bring my experience to helping to lead those organisations, you know, strategically, and I love doing that. So I hope that for the next few years, you know, before I retire, I'll be able to continue with that sort of experience. That's really my passion now, Jake. But it includes and involves continuing to lobby for the rights of people with disabilities.
Super important. And I saw another advocate there, your mate there sitting on the ground. Yeah. Is it a he or a she?
It's a female dog. Yes. Female dog, this one. And I've had three guide dogs now. She's there lying asleep. She's sort of my alter ego. She has lots of sleep interspersed with short periods of busy activity, and I have lots of busy activity interspersed with short periods of sleep. So, you know, but we work well as a team, and she plays an important role in my life. And as all three of them have done since I started to use a guide dog.
Yeah, and important tools, like important animals the powers that they possess. So, because I know you got it when it's got to do with training, and when it's got to do with the upkeep. So do you have, is it someone that comes out every couple of months or once a year and they just check on the dog and check X, Y, and Z? I know with companion dogs, they do, like, it's different but similar in ways, but what's the upkeep and training there?
Well, most of it's left up to me once I've done the initial training. So that certainly gets support from the guide dog organisations for that. I get my dogs through Guide Dogs New South Wales, and there is like an annual checkup, but someone like me who's used to working with guide dogs now, it's a relatively cursory process. So I manage the dog's grooming and veterinary care and all of those sorts of things. Obviously, you know, I don't do the actual vet work, but she goes to the vet regularly for injections and stuff like that. as does any working animal. And I make sure that she's fit and well and has an appropriate diet so that she can keep doing her job to the best of her ability.
And doing it well. So, hey, and I want to touch on this before we start wrapping it up, right? Because I was amazed when I come and saw you in your office in Sydney when you were serving as a commissioner. And I'm like, look at this bloke's cricket bats on the walls. I'm like, there'd be so many envious people out there seeing some of the cricket memorabilia that you had on the walls. I was amazed. So you're a bit of a cricket fanatic. Is that fair to say?
Oh, I'm an absolute cricket tragic, Jake. There's no doubt about it. And I lean into that role. I love cricket. That's the sport I follow, and I follow it around the world. And I do have a bit of cricket memorabilia and lots of fantastic memories, both of playing cricket. I played for my club and for New South Wales, and I was actually one of the people on the first in the first Australian team to tour overseas. We went to Sri Lanka back in 1981. Cricket's always been part of my life, and I'm just an avid watcher and follower of the game.
That's awesome. So what else does Graham Innes do in his spare time?
I like to read. I like to spend time with my family. I love the water, so I like to get out on boats. We've got two of my mates and I own a boat, which is in Sydney Harbour. We live on a canal now in Tweed Heads, my wife and I, so we've got a little tinny at the back of the house, which we take out. I enjoy the odd glass of dry white wine when I relax. That's pretty much the rest of my life.
Nice. And is some of that white wine, you know, accompanied with, you know, some fresh flathead that you've pulled out of the river there, or what?
I'm not a big fisher, Jake.
Plenty of fish up there, Graham.
Oh, there's stacks, mate. But I like someone else to catch them. I'm very happy to help eating them. but I don't like to go through the process of catching and preparing. So I tend to buy my fish with a silver hook get it at the local restaurants and fish and chip shops. And there's some awesome fish up there on Bundjalung land where I live. The fishing is fantastic.
Shout out, mob, Bundjalung country.
Yep.
Nice country out that way. So,
it's beautiful.
I really appreciate your time. And, you know, even when I first met you, this is going back in 2012, because when I served as an ambassador too on the 20 years, 20 stories of the DDA. And, and that was a great experience. And it's just good to see, you know, how you've paved the way for many, and, you know, and this is echoing, you know, forever. So, and a lot of people within the industry that, you know, if they're working in the disability sector or outside of it, you know, really know who you are and what you've done, and which is super important. And hey, Mr. Bill Shorten, you know, if you're listening to this, you know, we've got Mr. Graham Innes here. Like I'm saying, you know, I don't want to put you on the spot again, but, you know, you're an important part of the fabric of this disability community in this country. So, you know, really appreciate your time. And just if you want to put out your social media handles or whatever it may be, like, or any messages that you want to put out there for people, like, throw all that out in the atmosphere.
Oh, look, Jake, I am happy to contribute in any way I can to improve the lives of all Australians, but mainly the lives of Australians with disabilities, and to make sure that we have a more equal place in the country. You've been very generous with your comments. I've had a few opportunities to do a few things, and I've tried to maximise what I could do with those opportunities, but that's always what my passion has been, building our stronger community, and we do that through building stronger individuals and building the diversity of our community so that, you know, our people from different cultures can come and contribute, people with who are same-sex attracted can, people with disabilities can, and our First Nations people get the role that in which they can contribute rather than the role that they've been placed in by white society for the past 200 years. So, you know, I'm excited for things like the Voice to Parliament and for Indigenous Australians, and I'm excited for things like improvements to the NDIS, and for things like, letting go the hand of our parent nation and becoming a republic rather than a monarchy. I'm excited for all that stuff, and I enjoy being part of it.
Awesome. Really, really appreciate that. Strong words. And I'll just say, if people want to get you on Twitter or any other social media handles, what are they and how can they reach out?
Well, I'm at Graeme Innes, so GRAEMEINNES, and I've got a website, www.graeminnes.com, and there's a few YouTube things up there that I've been able to do. This podcast might get up there in the fullness of time. So that's where I am, happy to contribute where I can.
Absolute trailblazer. Love your work. Appreciate your time. It's been an honour, and I'll look forward to how your voice is going to continue along and help people with disabilities. So really appreciate it, Graeme.
Thanks, Jake. It's a pleasure to talk with you, and best wishes with your work as well, and with your podcast, and with the work that you do to advance the rights, particularly of First Nations people, but across the board of all people with disabilities.
Appreciate it. Thanks. See, folks, Mr. Graeme Innes absolutely paving the way for Mob with Disability. It's all about inclusion. You know, coming up against a lot of organisations, individuals in the community, ableism, and it's shown what's possible, the capabilities of people with disability. We're not going to be quiet. We're not going away. We're here to level the playing field, folks. And if you like the podcast, hit that subscribe or follow button. And we've also got a Patreon page. The link is within the description. So if you want to become a patron and roll with the squad, that'd be great. And if you want to get in contact with me, you can get me via Instagram at streetrollandcheetah or email one word streetrollandcheetah@gmail.com. And we've also got a Facebook page, Keep Rolling with Jake Briggs. So check it out. And want to thank our sponsors. Permobil Australia, the greatest electric wheelchairs in the land. Wouldn't be sitting in anything else but these four wheels right here, and they've got great assistive tech also. So righto, see you on the next one.